Drew Chapman is joining us here with the Guadalajara Geopolitics podcast. He has a history degree, and he is an author and television writer and producer. He has written for Fox, Universal, and Sony, among other studios, and has written and directed a feature film called Standoff. He has also written and produced ABC's The Assets Limited TV series and produced Legends for TNT. His first novel, The Ascendants, was published last year, and he just recently released the sequel, King of Fear. We'll be talking about geopolitics in the realm of fiction, as well as what it's like working with the topic of geopolitics in the world of television and publishing. Drew, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the theme of geopolitics and fiction. One of the goals of geopolitics, as I see it, is to understand the reality of international affairs and what is really happening geographically in a place and why. And I interview guests who attempt to decipher these seeming mysteries of current events. So maybe you can start off by telling us about your first novel, The Ascendants, and how writing about some of these political economic themes in fiction is similar and different to real world geopolitical events.
Okay, that's a great question. Well, you know, I mean, I'll sort of talk about what the book is about in a moment, but I would say that my overall sort of philosophy when it comes to fiction and geopolitics is I'm obsessed with geopolitics of all kinds, economics, you know, the sort of military groupthink between nations. And what I look for when I'm about to write a book or gonna create a television show is I look for the thing in the world that seems to create the most fear among the people, of mostly in the United States, because that's my main audience. But, you know, my book's been translated into a bunch of languages, and the television shows all get sold around the world. So I'm always looking for that thing in the world of geopolitics that just strikes a nerve in people, so that when they read about it in my books, or they see it on the television in the newscast or in a television show, they begin to, in a way, panic. And that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for that in, that psychological in people that says, oh my God, this is scary. I need to hear about this story.
And I mean, fear does sell, but it's also interesting and it's attractive. You know, we're all attracted to it and watching these movies. And what are some topics off the bat that you see happening right now that you could, you know, pull into a novel?
Well, I'll talk about my first novel and then the second novel. So the first book, The Ascendant, is a geopolitical thriller. And the sort of core idea of the story is that it centers around this young kid who is 26 years old, and he's a bond trader on Wall Street. And his specialty is pattern recognition. He looks to see the way that bonds or stocks are being sold on Wall Street and around the world, and he makes money off of those patterns. And at the beginning of the book, what he sees is that somebody is selling off massive amounts of U.S. treasuries to attack the American economy. And then what he realizes is that the people who are selling off these treasuries are the Chinese, and that what's going on is that there's an underground, almost invisible war going on between the U.S. and China. And that war is cyber, and it's psychological, and it's economic, but it's never an actual shooting war. And he gets recruited by the U.S. government to help fight that war because he's so good at what he does. The complication on a sort of psychological character level is that this character, Garrett Riley, he's you know, for lack of a better word, he's an asshole. He's only interested in making money. He's not interested in patriotism. He hates groupthink, and he hates the U.S. government, and he hates the military more than anything. And so here's this guy who's a real troublemaker and a pothead and a womanizer and a drinker being recruited by the U.S. military to fight this war that he has really no interest in fighting. And so all of those things sort of, I blend them together to create this narrative, you know, in the book. I think the geopolitical thing that I'm interested in the first book is what is going on between the United States and China, and how here are these, you know, one emerging superpower, one sort of old guard superpower kind of squaring off against each other. And how is that battle being fought? Because it's obviously not being fought with bullets, not yet, at least. Might be someday. But there's no doubt that, you know, while the US and China are trading partners and in a sense, you know, not at war with each other, we are still very much in competition. And that competition is not just strictly a who sells the most amount of goods competition. It is a competition for power. And that is, to me, fascinating. And the fear part of it to the audience, to me, is as Americans, we've sort of grown used to this status in the world as the world's only superpower. And we are, you know, we control basically everything. And that's perhaps being contested by the Chinese. And I think that is a fascinating geopolitical question and world to explore. And so that's what goes on in the first book, The Ascendant.
And this is a cutting edge topic. I remember when I was in grad school, I don't know what, seven years ago, and one of my geopolitics professors recommended a book published by a Chinese military official called Unrestricted Warfare, which touches precisely on what you're talking about, non-military fighting, you know, in the realm of cyber warfare, economy. And there's a lot of folks today, like Jim Rickards, who's written the book, The Death of Money, Martin Armstrong, who's came out with a documentary called The Forecaster, and who the government put in jail because his forecasts were so accurate, and he wouldn't share his information with them. So the topic is really cutting edge. What does the research look like in writing a novel like The Ascendant? Where did you go to get some of the background information?
Well, I mean, you know, research to me is, in some ways, even more fun than actually writing the book. I love doing research, and I was a journalist long ago, and so that's my background. And so I just love it. So what did I do? I went to China. I traveled all around. I spoke to as many people as I could. I had friends who, you know, I live in Seattle most of the time, and so Seattle has a lot of ties with China through Microsoft, through all these tech companies. So, and I know lots of people at Microsoft, so they hooked me up with businessmen in China, officials in China, all kinds of people who I could just go and talk to and travel around and see what that world was. Then I spoke to, I spent a lot of time hanging out with people who work on trading desks, Wall Street types all around the country who trade bonds or trade stocks, who are just, you know, people who live in what I call the information flow, you know, that sea of economic information that's just floating around all the time, and they're picking up on little tidbits of it. And that's sort of my character. And so I was fascinated by those people and what they do. And a lot of the time I spent with the people trading bonds, for instance, I posited the exact idea of the book to them. I said, hey, what would happen if the Chinese all of a sudden decided to drop, you know, to just sell off a couple $100 billion worth of US treasuries? And, you know, they all panicked. It was all of them. That was their fear. That was the thing that terrifies them. It's like that would really shoot a hole in the American economy. Now, at the same time, it would be a devastating thing for the Chinese economy because we are so interconnected. And to me, that's part of the fun of it all. So the underlying idea in the book is that in China, the reason that the Chinese are selling off all these treasuries is because there's an insurrection going on in China. Because a peasant woman who's lost her land and her husband is starting to basically become a new Mao in China and rise up against the party. And all the research that I did in China, of course, you can't really do this research in China. You can only do it elliptically because they are not very happy about that. Mm-hmm. But what I, you know, the people I spoke to mostly outside of China for this, you know, I said, well, what does the Chinese government fear most? And they don't really fear the Americans. I mean, we're not going to invade China. And they don't fear the Japanese, and the, you know, and they're worried about economic meltdown for sure, like everybody is. But what they really fear, what the Communist Party really fears, is their own people. What they really fear is a rising up of the 1.3 billion or so Chinese who are not members of the Communist Party, who don't have vast wealth, and wiping out their power and riches, you know, in a matter of weeks, which is completely possible. So that is the, that research was fascinating. And that is the sort of, that's the plot idea behind the book. That's the reason the Chinese are sort of provoking war with the Americans by selling off massive amounts of treasuries.
And I would totally agree with that fear you described of the Chinese government. I think that's one of the number one fears of many governments, especially totalitarian ones. And it's in line with some of the recent news. So this book came out, I think, 2014. And I don't know if you heard the news recently that supposedly the Chinese Communist government is attempting to create these citizen scores, or like an internet driver's license, where each citizen in China will have some type of a citizen score. And if they are found to criticize the government, their score will get lower. And then if you, you know, do good by the government standards, you'll get a higher score, and you'll get perks and privileges based on that score. So, you know, if you get a lower score and you want to go take a trip outside of China and you need a visa, you'll get denied it. And so then you have to kind of go along with the government to get the perks. And so it's kind of what you're talking about, where that's their fear. They need to control the population. And I don't know if you have anything to add there.
Well, it sounds like it's a political Yelp score. Everybody gets their own Yelp score in China.
Actually, it's funny that you mentioned that, because there was another story where a separate company just a few weeks ago were going to make Yelp for people. So you could, people's real names would be online, and you can rate them based on your experience with them.
God. I mean, you know, it had to happen, but I'm not sure how I feel about it.
Well, I think
Well, here's the interesting story for me is that before I went to China, I was researching the book, and I'd actually written a very rough draft of the book. And while I was doing it, I had a blog, and I was blogging about things about the US and China and information warfare and cyber war and economic war, and just, you know, really delving deep into all of these subjects and you know, posting articles and doing exactly what you do, look for these different ideas. And you can track who's reading your blog and where they're reading it from, right? So I had lots of readers in the United States. I had some in Europe. Nobody in China. Nobody ever read my blog in China. Nobody cared. Like, literally, not a single person. Then I go to China. The book is still not out yet. And while I'm there, I post blog postings from China, inside of China. And the moment I do that, my blog gets totally overwhelmed with readers in China. And I start getting really strange email messages like, where are you? Where are you staying in China? What are you doing here? Why are you here? And it so freaked me out that I immediately just shut down the blog and never, you know, I didn't do anything again while I was in China. I waited till I was back in the United States. But, you know, the lesson I learned is that the Chinese government really doesn't care what you say about them or what you do, as long as you're not inside of China. You can write, you know, blistering takedowns of Xi Jinping or anybody about corruption in the government. They could care less. But if you're doing it in China with other Chinese people, they panic. And that to me was just totally telling about, you know, the standing of the Communist Party and their control and, you know, of the people.
It's really fascinating. I have a history background myself, and I read that you also have a history degree. I was just curious how useful was your history degree in all of this?
You know, I think it's, I don't know that the history degree is necessarily useful. I think that my degree in history is just representative of my obsessions, and my obsessions are what I love writing about. And this goes for television, this goes for books. I love writing about ordinary people, everyday people who are caught up, who are swept up in the sort of great waves and movements of history, right? So the average guy who suddenly finds himself in this situation that he had no idea would happen, and the reason it's happening is because of geopolitical events. Mm-hmm. I find that it just activates some part of my imagination. I find it very romantic. I find it very heroic, dark, cynical, all those things. I just, you know, it is, that's what I love. For instance, I wrote a television show, a pilot that, and we can talk about, this would be sort of delving into the world of geopolitics in the entertainment business, but mm-hmm. I wrote a pilot that we shot as a pilot, but never got on the air as a television show. And the idea of it was, and I did this almost 10 years ago, it was about the coming of the next civil war in the United States between the red states and the blue states. And it was about a farmer in Kansas who is going broke and decides to stage a tax rebellion. And his tax rebellion sort of catches fire, and all of a sudden there's an actual like civil war going on in the United States. And I sold it to the ABC network, which is a subsidiary of the Disney Corporation. And they loved it, but it was so political and so scary in its politics that they could never actually put it on the air. So, you know, I think if and when we talk about censorship in the world of, you know, TV, mm-hmm. it wasn't direct censorship, but it was certainly a fear that things would be too scary. But the idea, again, is for me, what it's representative of is here's this guy. He's a farmer. He's just trying to keep his land. He does this small thing, which he thinks will be a small thing, a small tax protest, and it sort of rumbles out of control, and he gets caught up in the forces of history. And I love that. And so to me, I'm always, you know, in my study of history, I mean, I specialize in American history, but I love all of it. I think that the idea that there are these concepts that sweep through nations and sweep through the world at certain points in our history and change the world, and people get swept up in these ideas, these revolutionary ideas, be they conservative or liberal or whatever they are. I try not to take a political point of view on any of this. I find it fascinating. And by the way, the non-political point of view is important to me. I mean, I have my own political point of view, but I'm more interested in the characters and their struggle in the world than in representing some larger, very distinct political point of view. Mm-hmm. It's always the personal for me.
And that's a very prescient topic because, you know, just I think this week or last week, Erwin Schiff, the father of the famous Peter Schiff, died, and he was a tax protester. I guess he had the only nonfiction book that was banned in the U.S. And then we had the case, I don't know, it was a year or two ago, a guy who flew the plane into the IRS. So the other instances of the Bureau of Land Management attempting to take away land from.
The guy in Nevada, that rancher.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's all there. And speaking of television and media, you know, I had a question. I don't know how much you've run across or are tuned to the subject. But, you know, one of the top questions for me regarding television in the U.S. is the connection between, or if there is a connection. Well, I mean, it has been proven that there is some connection between Hollywood, television, media, with the Pentagon, CIA, and the U.S. government. And there are two academic studies that I'm aware of. One is by Oliver Boyd Barrett. It's called Hollywood and the CIA, Cinema, Defense, and Subversion. He discusses a certain synergy between the two and how American war films seek to normalize CIA behavior. And the other one is Trisha Jenkins, called The CIA in Hollywood, and she discusses the CIA's active role in shaping the content of film and television. What would be your perspective and analysis of this synergy between the government and television and film media in the U.S.?
Well, that is a very, very complicated question, and we could certainly talk about it for hours. Let's see. Well, There's a lot of parts of that. So on the one hand, it's absolutely true. The government, or the specifically the Pentagon and certain television shows and certain movies are very cozy. And the military actually, the Pentagon wants you to create shows and or movies that show the Pentagon or the military, the Navy, the Army, the Marines, whatever, in a good light. And if you do, they will give you lots and lots of access to their boats and planes and bases and so on. So, I don't know that there have certain there's been that show The Last Ship is all set on a U.S. destroyer. It's on TNT, and I think that's done entirely with the cooperation of the Pentagon. Now, all the characters are military people, and some of them are good, and some of them are bad, and so it's I mean, it's not a complete whitewash, but in general, the military are heroic in that show. And so that's just on a very, very basic level. Like, if you write a show that we approve of, we'll let you use our stuff. And I don't blame them for that. I mean, I don't, if you're going to write something that's horribly critical of the military, I could see how they would go, well, no, you're not going to, I'm not going to aid and abet you in that particular endeavor. It seems like that would be against our own self-interest. So I get that. I think there are plenty of movies where the military does not come off particularly well, where the military makes mistakes. You just don't get to do it with the help of the military. So I think, that's a very straightforward way of looking at it, right? That's a very surface level. I think that one of my problems with this country as it stands right now is that we are so fetishistic about the military. And so enthrall to them. I think we spend so much money on our military, and it is so, I don't know how necessary it is, and it makes me nervous. It makes me nervous that we no longer have a draft and we just have an all-volunteer force. I mean, these are personal opinions, and I am very grateful that there are people out there who want to be in the military and who are fighting the battles that, we, our government feels needs to be fought. I don't always agree with those battles, but I'm grateful that those people exist. I think the more complicated question is, what are the less obvious ways in which the military and or the CIA shapes what you do, shapes what you write. So, for instance, I have the last two television shows that I worked on, one of them is called Legends that I'm working on now, or just finished, and it's airing now. And it's a spy show for TNT, and it has all kinds of FBI and CIA and MI6, the British intelligence agency, characters in it. And then before that, I worked on a show called The Assets, which was the story of Aldrich Ames. You know who Aldrich Ames is?
Yeah, during the Cold War, the who spa gave this to the Soviets, he gave the information.
Yes, he gave over a dozen or maybe more names to the Soviets of people who were Soviet citizens in the KGB who were working for the Americans. And almost all of those people were summarily executed by the Russians as soon as they found out. So he was a CIA turncoat. So in both of these shows, we had many people who were either current, but mostly former CIA and FBI agents working for us, helping us with research, telling us what they did and how it worked and how they did it. And when you get it like that, when you get people who are no longer in the agency, but who know the agency very well, you get a much more nuanced view of what the American spy agencies do right and what they do wrong. And they aren't as interested in shaping your show or your piece of art to, sort of match a propaganda, right? They're interested in like what's real And that's what you're always asking them. Like, what's it really like? What's it really like to be a spy? What's it really like to work at Langley? What's it really like to be an FBI agent? And so in that case, you aren't making a show that is sort of influenced by the larger ideas of the agency. But what you do end up doing is you begin to like the people who are helping you, because you spend time with them and you talk to them all day long and they tell you these stories, and what they do is interesting. I mean, what, you know, what case officers do in the CIA is really fascinating. And so you sort of shape your show to show these people in a better light because you like them. And so that is part of, that is also what happens, what, you know, in the sort of internal nitty gritty of creating a television show. In Hollywood. The other thing is, and this is more of a, even, this is an even more indirect sort of influence, is that you look around and in general, your television audience is pro-military and they're pro-CIA or they're pro-FBI or they're pro-police. The people who watch these kind of shows aren't necessarily watching the show to be told that their government agency is doing a bad job. So they're looking for heroes. And so you shape the show almost unconsciously to give the audience what it wants, and those things are heroes. And so in a sense, it's kind of a self-fulfilling thing. They're not, you know, the CIA isn't coming to you and saying, oh, you really should write this show about a heroic CIA agent. But in a sense, because you know that's what the audience wants, you kind of give it to them.
And just another question on the government and film and media, you know, are certain stories, do you think, worn out? It seems there's so many movies about, you know, American wars like in Iraq and Afghanistan, Zero Dark 30, American Sniper. Do you think some of that we're running thin on some of the themes? Are we running out of artistic runway, as we might say? Does it get a bit repetitive? Or, I mean, I think what you're doing with the China story, that's a current theme. That's a new theme. But in general, what do you see there?
Well, the sort of conventional wisdom in Hollywood is that, and this goes for television shows and for movies, is that movies about Iraq and Afghanistan make no money. So Zero Dark 30, it made a little bit of money. It wasn't like a huge runaway hit. It won a lot of Oscars, and so that was great. But in general, the conventional wisdom has always been people don't want to see movies about Iraq and Afghanistan, American involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's too depressing. That the American audience sees it on television all the time, on the news, they read about it, and it's just awful, and they don't want to see it. American Sniper did well, and, you know, I can't, you know, you can never explain why something does well or something doesn't do well. It broke the mold in general. There have been a bunch of television shows about Iraq and Afghanistan, and they've never gone anywhere. People just don't want to go back there day out, you know, week after week. They don't want their characters going back. It's easier a little bit to make a movie about it where it's just a one-time thing. But even then, in general, it has not been a good thing. So are we running thin? I don't think we've actually even run the whole, you know, like, I don't think we've explored it enough. I think that in 10 or 20 years, we'll start to see more and more movies about American involvement in both Afghanistan and Iraq. And those movies will be good because they'll have the vantage point of history, and it won't be as immediate. I hope that we're still not in Afghanistan in 10 or 20 years. Maybe we will be, who knows? But, you know, it's sort of like, the best Vietnam War movies came, you know, like Platoon, they came after the Vietnam War, not during the Vietnam War. That tends to be the case. Same thing with World War II movies. You don't make the movie right when it's all happening. It's all too intense. You make it afterwards. So my guess is that you'll see them later on.
That's a good observation. You know, Band of Brothers was one of my favorite series, and I use it in some of my classes when we touch on World War II. Your last blog post, I thought, was really good, very poignant, and something I can relate to. You compare your real children to your work, your TV productions, and published books. which would be your fictional children. And, you know, I see the same in the world of podcasting with globalization and technology. You know, the entertainment options are endless. There's so much noise now in the crowded marketplace, as you say. You know, for example, we saw U2, the biggest band in the world, supposedly. They ended up giving away their album for free on iTunes. And if the biggest band in the world has to do that, you know, what does that say for the rest of us? So what's your take on this, you know, new digital revolution and digital media? Because it seems ebooks and audio MP3 books are gaining precedence to the physical book. iTunes audio podcasts and YouTube video podcasts and online Netflix and Amazon streaming are gaining precedence to the traditional cable and satellite. You know, what's your take on these changes?
Well, I mean, God, that's such a huge question. And I only have opinions, and I can sort of tell you what people inside the business are thinking, sure. But I will tell you right from the start that nobody has the answer. Like, anyone who pretends to have the answer is lying. They don't know. Everyone is trying to figure out, like, in the book business. So my new book, The King of Fear, is being released digitally first as in serialized fashion. So the first third, the second third, and the third third are all being released in one first now, then in another month, then another month. And then the actual paperback book will come out in February of 2016. And why are they doing this? Why is Simon & Schuster, my publisher, doing it? Because they're just trying anything. They will try anything to make it, you know, make it stick. They're afraid of ebooks. They're afraid of self-publishing. The world of publishing is changing. It's turning upside down. The old publishing houses have less and less power. There are all these people who are self-publishing books. Some of those books, 99% of those books, nobody reads, but then every once in a while, a book takes off and it becomes this huge bestseller. So it's really like it's a topsy-turvy world. In the world of publishing, a world I know less, not as well as I know television, you know, I'm all for it. I mean, I think that the digital revolution is amazing. I don't necessarily want to read all those thousands of self-published books out there on Amazon.com. I mean, I've read a few of them and they tend to be just terrible. So I'm not going to waste my time. I think that there is room in this world for what we would call the gatekeeper, the editor who decides what is good and what is bad. I think those people are really valuable. It's not particularly democratic. Like, you can't just throw your stuff up there and hope that a gatekeeper likes it. I mean, you are doing that. You're hoping. The role of the gatekeeper isn't democratic, and yet I think it is a good thing to have. You know, where does the publishing industry go? I don't know. I think the sales of Kindles and ebook readers has flattened out, and people are reading. I think that ultimately people are reading more. I think you're reading more on your iPad. I think you're reading more on your phone. And I think that's great. I love that. I love technology, and I think it's fantastic that I can take my phone along with me and I can read Moby Dick while I'm standing in line at the grocery. You know, I love that. In the world of television and movies, it's a less wide open problem, because, you know, if I want to write a novel and self-publish it, all I have to do is sit at home, you know, in the evenings for a year and write that novel, and then I, you know, press a button and I publish it. If I want to create my own movie or television show, that's a lot harder. Television, video, or film requires money, and it requires actors, and it requires crew, and it requires time. So that's a huge advantage for the television networks and for the movie studios, because they have money. So that will always keep sort of the true amateurs out. That said, I think there are great, you know, small video shows being made on YouTube, and all these podcasts are fantastic. I mean, I'm addicted to podcasts. I listen to them all the time. You know, I think that the television business is very, very nervous about the rise of the digital entertainment universe. it, you know, if you look at the show that I have out right now called Legends, the spy show on TNT, they released the first episode on YouTube before they released it on TNT. They released it a week early, and it got 1 million views on YouTube. And that was fantastic, and we were all really happy. But then when it showed at 10 o'clock on Monday night on TNT, mm-hmm. it only got 500,000 people watching it. So in a way, they had shot their wad on YouTube and kind of, you know, hurt themselves in terms of their overnight ratings on television. And they did it on purpose because they wanted to, you know, promote the show in every which way possible. But in the end, it may not have been the smartest idea. I don't know. You know, I don't know. And they won't be able to know until the run of the show is over. But it is a conundrum for them. They, you know, they're constantly struggling to figure out how to get a bigger audience. Now, for me as a writer, and also for me as a viewer of television, I think that the propagation of all these new channels is fantastic. I love that there are so many digital channels out there with so many television shows. I think television's never been better. I think it's never been as sophisticated. There's more stuff out there of more varied niche stuff. Some of it's smart, a lot of it terrible. But compared to the old days when you had four networks and, you know, very controlled sort of stuff, this is fantastic. There's more television out there than I can possibly watch, at least to my taste.
And regarding the first episode of the show, Legends, that was put up on YouTube, do you think that could also be a gauge, perhaps, that maybe less people are watching television and more are, especially the younger generation, they're using YouTube to view stuff, you know, through their smartphones? Could that also be something there to that?
Oh, there's no doubt. Everybody in television takes that as a given. The audience, the young audience, is fragmenting, and there's so many other things to do and so many other ways to watch television. And you have to separate it out. It's like, are those people not watching TV? Are they playing video games? Are they, you know, skateboarding? Are they, you know, reading? What are they doing other than watching traditional television on a television? Are they actually watching the television show, but they're watching it on their phone, on YouTube, or they're watching it on Hulu? Are they watching it on Netflix? Or, like my daughters, even though I tell them not to, are they watching it ripped on BitTorrent when they shouldn't? Because they're basically taking money out of their own mouths because their dad makes money making television shows. Is that how people are watching? And what does that do for, you know, again, here's the thing for me, I'm always interested in where the money comes from. So like, what's the ultimate economic win for a television network? If people are watching it in all these different ways, then they're not going to be able to make television that's free anymore. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be able to just like turn on ABC or NBC and watch a show. Now, I personally don't really watch that many shows that way anyway. I tend to watch them later on Netflix or buy them on Amazon so I don't have to watch them with commercials. Now we get into a whole different thing. It's not geopolitical. It's more of a creative question. Mm-hmm. I much prefer to watch television shows commercial free, and I'm willing to pay for that privilege. And a lot of people out there are willing to pay for that as well. And so what you're going to see is, and again, maybe this is a little bit more geopolitical, what you're going to see is shows that are free on mainstream networks like ABC or NBC or CBS are going to slowly, I believe, be catering to people who can no longer afford to buy their television shows and watch them commercial free. So you're going to have a show like Empire. Do you know the show Empire on Fox?
No.
Okay. So Empire is a big hit show, and it's all about a family that runs a hip hop music business. And it is a primarily black show, and it is a really fun, big, splashy show, but it's a black show. And demographically, African Americans in the United States have less disposable income than whites. And this is my theory, and it may be wrong, may be right, but I believe that what is happening is that networks are going to start demographically changing their shows to appeal to people who cannot afford to watch shows in other ways. And Empire is a classic example. Are you following what I'm sort of saying?
Yeah, I would totally agree. I mean, it makes total economic sense.
And so you're going to see the shows that are super, like, the shows on HBO, the shows on Amazon.com are going to be big, expensive shows that you have to pay per episode to see. And they will be demographically targeted at middle and upper middle class Americans of whatever race or ethnicity. And the shows that show up on networks will be targeted at lower demographics. That's my prediction. I don't know if it'll really come true, but that's my guess.
I think it makes a lot of sense, and I would agree with you there. Why don't you tell us about your newest book, which it says is the sequel to Ascendant, The King of Fear, which you said will be coming out month by month, and is part of a trilogy, I think. So,
yeah. So like I said, the first book, The Ascendant, has this main character, Garrett Riley, and he fights this invisible war with the Chinese. And then this is a follow-up, a sequel, and the same character, Garrett Riley, is in it. And this time we take on an entirely different geopolitical idea, which is the rise of conflict, the rise again of conflict between the United States and Russia. And I really became fascinated with sort of the new Cold War when I spent 3 or 4 months in Eastern Europe a couple of years ago working on a television show. When we did the Aldridge Ames, the Asset show for ABC, we shot it in Lithuania. And I'd never been to Eastern Europe before. And traveling around, I just found the presence of Russia, the history of these countries with the Soviet Union and their current fear of Russia totally fascinating. And the way that, you know, the way that Russia sort of loomed over the idea of all these Baltic countries, that it was this massive, hostile, kind of terrifying place with this history of, you know, subjugating these countries and just controlling them and massacring their, you know, in Vilnius in Lithuania, there's the KGB museum that, you know, is dedicated to all the people that the KGB basically lined up and shot, who were Lithuanians. And I found that fascinating. And so I found the whole idea that this wounded Russia will rise again and start confronting America to be really interesting. So in the new book, which the first section has already come out, it came out last week, and the next section will come out in December, beginning of December, and then the third section in the beginning of January. The idea is that in Belarus, the sort of Soviet client state, the Russian client state in Eastern Europe, an election goes bad. And somehow the secret police, the Belarusian secret police, allow, through incompetence, a reform candidate to get into a runoff with the dictator. And the Russians are so enraged, like what's happening in Ukraine, that they have to find a way to make sure that in that runoff election, the dictator wins and the reform candidate does not win. And so what you see over the course of the book is that the Russians try to find a way to discredit the West and discredit the Western economic system. And so what this book is about is the, again, for research purposes, what I was interested in are is the 2008 meltdown that happened in the United States. And so what the Russians are trying to do is recreate a 2008 economic meltdown in the United States to steer all their post-Soviet client states back to Mother Russia and away from the EU and the West. And so that was the research I did. And I talked to all these bankers and economists, and I said, look, if I was, you know, a big nation state with a big sovereign wealth fund, that money that I could throw around, and I wanted to destabilize the Western economy, what would I do? And so we just laid out these sort of crazy scenarios, of how you would go about destabilizing the American economy. And you didn't necessarily have to destroy it, because that's almost impossible. But if you could send it a shock, if you could make it teeter like it did in 2008, how would you do it? And every, you know, I spoke to a bunch of different economists, bankers, and they all had, they first of all, they love, you know, it makes them feel like the evil villain in a James Bond movie, and they just love coming up with these ideas. And we just laid out all these different ideas and ways you could do it, and it was fantastic. And so that's what the book is about. The book is about an economic hitman, an economic assassin who comes to the United States and starts to wreak havoc. And our lead character, Garrett Riley, who is the guy from The Ascendant, sees, because he's good at pattern recognition, sees that this guy has come to the United States and begins to see the early warning signs of somebody who's doing something horrible to the American economy. And he has to stop it.
And speaking of economic hitman, I don't know if you know John Perkins. He's somebody that... he wrote Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and that was his real job. And he's somebody that I've interviewed in the past on one of the podcasts. But yeah, what you mentioned, like Vladimir...
I love that book, by the way, and I have read it. It's great.
Yeah, good stuff. And Vladimir Putin, yeah, kind of like what you say. He's got the Eurasian Economic Union, and he's incorporating some of the old Soviet states in this new Eurasian Economic Union. Are there any topics that we might have missed that you think are important? And I mean, or perhaps there's an interesting story you have from working and producing television.
Interesting. I mean, I think that, you know, the thing that I want, that my obsession is that I wish that Americans were more obsessed with the geopolitics and the ways in which the greater world influenced, you know, what goes on in the United States. I feel like sometimes we are so, you know, we're so short-sighted, we're so insular. Like when I was in Eastern Europe, you know, Eastern Europe feels like this place that's just been constantly screwed over by either the West or the East. You know, they never just like, they're either getting overrun by Germans or they're getting overrun by Russians. And it's, you know, like Americans don't understand that. We don't get that sense of unease and that topsy-turvy nature. But I do think that it is coming to the fore more and more in the United States. I think that people are seeing the ways in which the world encroaches on our own domestic politics and on our own economics. And I find that fascinating. I find that that is, to me, the stuff of really interesting stories. Just like Confessions of an Economic Hitman, you know, the way that he made his living was fascinating, you know, and that was very much about getting other countries to buy American stuff with American loans. I mean, you know, it was just such a classic example. And for instance, what the Chinese are doing now in Africa, the way they are investing and selling their own goods and services and mining Africa for, you know, commodities, totally fascinating. The world is full of these great stories, and I want to tell them.
Yeah, there's so much stuff out there. What advice would you give to anybody trying to write a novel or nonfiction for publication, or even somebody trying to produce media? For those trying to produce for mainstream television, or as well as produce media independently, like myself, alternatively via the internet, iTunes, and YouTube?
You know, I think that the most important thing, above all other things, is to know yourself and to know your passions, to really spend some time figuring out what just floats your boat, you know, and I mean that like, not in a superficial way, like the thing that you can write over and over and over again and never get bored. Because the truth is, eventually, you're going to write the same thing over and over again. That's what happens. We really only have a couple of stories to tell in our lives. And, you know, I mean, maybe the greats can tell a bunch, but most of us are just ordinary people, and we're just, you know, we have a couple of things. And so you really need to figure that out. And once you figure out what that thing is, that driving topic, that obsessive thing, and it can be anything. It can be sex or money, or it can be men or women or injustice or who knows, or geopolitics, you know, then you can push forward, because the truth is, writing a novel or a television show or creating independent media, most of the time people are going to say no. You know, 90% of my life is having doors shut in my face, or people saying thank you, no thank you, or having something go out there and having it get terrible ratings, or having nobody buy it. It's just, that's the majority of stuff. You know, most stuff doesn't like just explode into a huge hit or even just get put out at all. So you have to be so, you have to be so thick-skinned, and you have to be so stubborn and so persistent. And to be that, you have to love the thing you're telling. You have to be just completely obsessed with it. And, you know, that is the ultimate sort of piece of advice I always tell. I mean, I teach writing classes, and I teach about writing for television. I mean, there's all kinds of specific things you can do. You know, write a spec script, or write a script that sounds like a show that's already on the air. Or if you're writing a novel, pick a genre and make sure that that genre is easily recognizable. All of those things are, you know, sort of hands-on building blocks that you can do. But the truth is, the most important is, know yourself, know what you love, and do that one thing. You know, I've written, God only knows how many screenplays, and ultimately, they're all kind of about the same thing. I mean, they're variations on a theme. And then when you look at the work of other people, you know, it's all kind of the same stuff. You know, I went to see the Steve Jobs movie that Aaron Sorkin wrote. And it's like, God, that guy just writes the same movie over and over and over again. But I really like those movies, and I think he's brilliant. But he just writes the same thing. And somehow he finds the thing in those stories that he thinks is great.
Yeah, I mean, I think your advice is great. And, you know, you talk about persistence. You need to have passion, because, you know, even me producing a podcast, it takes time and dedication. And if you're not passionate about it, you're going to leave it aside eventually. Well, I'll post the links to your site, and people can visit you at andrewdchapman.com, and people can purchase your books, The Ascendant and King of Fear, on amazon.com. Are there any other sites that you recommend?
Well, there's, you know, the book can also be gotten at iTunes and barnesandnoble.com. So, you know, I would say go to those things, and then I would just put the plug in for, go to your independent bookseller when it comes out in paperback in February, because it's really important to keep bookstores going, as well as having Amazon. Those people are the guides. They are the gatekeepers of what's good. And you know, they are a crucial part of our democracy. Bookstores really are important.
No, I would totally agree. Every time I visit the States, I still do. Every time I go to Barnes & Noble and purchase a physical book myself. Well, thank you, Drew Chapman, for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.